This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Our guest in this portion of the program is a journalist, and he is the author of Untapped, The Scramble for Africa's Oil. His name is John Gosvinian. He traveled through a dozen African nations in 2005. Following that trip, he traveled to Washington, London, and Paris, continuing his research on what Africa's oil boom means for the people of its oil-producing nations, what it means for the continent, and what it means for the rest of the world. Gosvinian reports one of every 9 gallons of fuel being pumped into any given car anywhere in the world on any given day comes from Africa. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, John Gosvinian. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. John Gosvinian is currently a visiting fellow at the University of Pennsylvania. He earned a PhD in history from Oxford. Born in Iran and raised in Los Angeles and London, his work has appeared in Newsweek, The Nation, Time Out New York, and other publications. His book, Untapped, The Scramble for Africa's Oil, is published by Harcourt. 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Excuse me. John, welcome to the program. Hi, how are you?
Hi, thanks for having me.
What led you to your interest in Africa and Africa's oil?
Well, a few years ago I've always been interested in Africa, but a few years ago I started to hear about how much oil was coming out of the African continent, and I was surprised to discover, as I think many people are when they first hear this, that we're actually getting about as much oil now, even more oil really now, from Africa than we do from Saudi Arabia, and that we're going to be getting, here in the United States, we're going to be getting as much as 25% of our imported oil from Africa in the next few years. And it just struck me as this is not something we hear very much about. You know, when we think of oil, we tend to think of other parts of the world, like the Middle East or Venezuela or Russia. And when we don't tend to think of Africa. In fact, when we think of Africa, we tend just to think of misery and suffering and poverty. You know, I think the two, you know, oil and Africa are things that don't necessarily go hand in hand in the popular imagination. So I was just trying to kind of learn a bit more about what was going on and bring that story to life a little bit for people.
Mm-hmm. You report that Africa is unlikely ever to replace the Middle East or any other major oil-producing region. It's believed to contain at best 10% of the world's proven oil reserves, but there are a number of important advantages to African oil. What are they?
Yeah, exactly. You know, the numbers are misleading. You know, I mean, yes, it's only about 10% of the world's reserves, but actually that's a very deceptive figure because African oil is light and sweet crude. It's what, you know, it's the oil man's oil. It's the kind of oil that is very cheap and easy to refine. So, you know, when it comes to North America or Europe, you know, where refineries have tough environmental standards, it means that it cuts your, you know, keeps your costs down. So it's more attractive than, say, the heavy crude in Venezuela or the sour stuff that we get in the Middle East. It's just a great quality of oil. It's also very easy for transport. Most of the oil from Africa comes from along the west coast of Africa, the Gulf of Guinea, which means really you can just put it on a boat and take it straight to, again, North America or Europe or wherever. You don't have to build a pipeline or you know, anything like that, or canals or what have you. And then, you know, it's mostly offshore. The new oil, the kind of oil boom of the last few years, has mostly been offshore, you know, which basically means people can work out in deep water, oil companies, and they don't have to worry about getting involved in volatile political situations in Africa, which in the past has been a real issue, especially in places like Nigeria.
Yeah, yeah. Africa's oil is of great interest to the U.S. This is a sort of an understatement. You report it's caused a good deal of excitement among politicians and strategists. Tell us about the thinking of and the strategizing that has been done by groups such as the African Oil Policy Initiative Group, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, so on and so forth.
Yeah, in a way, it's a no-brainer. I mean, we all know that the United States, one of the very high top priorities for this country for many years has been a diversification of the oil supply and diversification of our energy dependence. This is obviously taken on a new urgency in the last few years, since September 11th and so on, for, I think, obvious reasons. The United States is, President Bush has made it clear that he wants to reduce substantially America's dependence on the Middle East. Africa has been touted by many people close to neoconservative circles, especially as a kind of chance for a clean break from the Middle East, a chance to stick it to the Arabs and say, we don't need your oil anyway, we can get it from Africa. I think everywhere you go in America today, people are keen to break away from the Middle East, dependence on Middle Eastern oil. So Africa seems like a great opportunity to do that. Of course, it's got a lot of problems of its own that it brings.
Yeah. China is also interested. What is China's role here in this story?
China's got a huge role in this story, and one that grew substantially just in the couple of years that I was working on this book. China is now dependent on Africa for nearly 30% of its imported oil, which is even more than we are. So there is an obvious and building rivalry there between the United States and China in Africa. One that I think, by and large, the Chinese are well-placed to start winning fairly soon. Basically, they take a great deal of interest in Africa. Historically, they always have. They have a much more aggressive presence on the continent, and they're quite happy to sort of throw around money and say, look, just give us some oil. And frankly, the United States is quite distracted at the moment, obviously, by events in Iraq and the wider Middle East, and the Chinese have been moving in very swiftly and very aggressively.
So what will that mean for the U.S. long-term, do you think?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. I know there's a lot of people who see the Chinese presence in Africa as a fundamentally sinister and negative force, and obviously it has a lot of baggage and some question marks, particularly in China's willingness to cozy up to regimes that the United States considers to be pariahs, such as Zimbabwe. However, China also, I think, has been a force in many ways for good recently in Africa as well. I mean, for many, many years it has cooperated with Africans. It's trained many Africans in its universities, sent thousands of doctors to Africa. It's currently building railways and roads and airports in places that have been decimated by civil war. It gets in there, and the thing about China is, I think we all know this. The Chinese, one thing they can do well is they can build stuff, and they can build it quickly and cheaply. And I think anyone who's ever bought Chinese electronics understands this instinctively. They can just get in there, and they can build a road for a fraction of the cost that a European or American contractor will do it for, and they'll build it almost overnight. And in many places in Africa, this is very welcome.
Yeah. Do you think China's behavior in Africa could lead the U.S. to reconsider how it does business in Africa?
Possibly. I think that's definitely one of the speculations. For many years, the U.S. and the West in general have, as I think many of us know, set a lot of tough conditions on African governments for debt forgiveness and loan forgiveness and that kind of stuff. Restructuring of economies and cutting back on social spending and so on, the sort of so-called Washington consensus. These days, people in Africa kind of joke about the Beijing consensus, this idea that China says, look, you run your country the way you want. We're going to lend you some money so you can do the things that you need to do. And in return, we just ask for access to your oil wealth or your mines or what have you. Inevitably, I think this is going to stick in the throat of Western governments and maybe make them less strident about trying to impose a certain agenda on African governments. Mm. That's, I think, possibly a good thing, possibly a bad thing. I think only time will tell.
Yeah. You begin your story, basically, you begin in Nigeria, where oil companies have been for more than 40 years now, and you used ground travel to get from Lagos to the Delta. Tell us about that trip.
Yeah, never a dull moment. I didn't want to fly into the Delta. It was important for me to just really get on the ground and feel the difference between Lagos and the Niger Delta. For your listeners who may not be aware, Nigeria is an extremely important country to us, actually. It's the fifth largest supplier of oil to the United States, which is something a lot of people are not aware of. It's a major, major producer in the world. It's the world's seventh or eighth largest producer of oil. It's a member of OPEC, and it's been producing oil for 50 years. all the oil comes from the Niger Delta, which is a very, very, very poor part of the country where there are no roads, there's no electricity, no running water. There's just these mangrove swamps. Looks a bit like the Everglades in Florida, if you will, but without any kind of infrastructure, just little mud huts and so on, little canoes being rowed around by fishermen. It's a part of the world that has had enormous amounts of oil spilled into the creeks over the years. What you have is these multi-million-dollar oil facilities and thousands of miles of pipelines crisscrossing the delta, these air-conditioned facilities and so on, right next to these villages of straw huts. And for many years, there's been a lot of frustration because people have not seen their lives improve. And about 10, 15 years ago, the sort of rather nasty militant insurgency began, and it's got worse and worse over the years. I was just in Nigeria last month. In the last year and a half, there have been nearly 200 foreign oil workers kidnapped in the Niger Delta by these shadowy groups, these militant groups, who many of them steal crude oil out of pipelines. They sell it on the black market. They use it to buy money to buy weapons and put together these militias. It's a nasty, nasty piece of business down there.
Yeah. Bunkering and illegal bunkering. That's the stealing of, well, bunkering is the legal deal, but illegal bunkering is the stealing part of this deal. It's dangerous. It's extremely dangerous, but it's also very profitable. Tell us about that.
Extremely profitable. Basically, if you're it has to be said, first of all, that the federal government of Nigeria has taken some real steps to crack down on this in the last sort of year or two since I did the reporting for the book. But it still goes on. But when I was there, it was at its height. And, you had 100,000, 200,000 barrels a day just disappearing into the hands of crude oil thieves. This is part of a fairly organized criminal network, really. That's probably gone down a bit. But, the thing is, anytime you have that much oil, you're talking about 10% of Nigeria's daily oil production. It's just not coming onto the international market. It's you've got gangs of teenagers just drilling holes into pipelines and sucking the oil out and putting it onto these little plastic jerry cans and rolling it out to offshore, off to the coastline where you have these Eastern European oil tankers waiting to take the oil off to refineries and neighboring countries. It was and still is a fairly well organized criminal racket that even the highest levels of the Nigerian political establishment have profited from.
Hmm. Ethnic rivalries, have been exacerbated by the oil industry in Nigeria. How?
Well, Nigeria is a country of 140 million people. It is a country also of 200 plus ethnic groups. It's a pretty tense place at the best of times. And oil, billions of dollars of oil wealth that has flown into the country in the last 40 years has, frankly, not surprisingly, not really helped the situation. There's been a lot of squabbling over access to resource control, basically. The people of the Delta feel that they're being ripped off. They feel that they're not getting the money from the oil that's under their homes and their land. And that's basically true. It's been stolen and embezzled and put away into foreign bank accounts for many years. Nigeria's own anti-corruption czar estimates that since 1960, $380 billion, with a B, has been siphoned off thanks to corruption in oil money. That's an enormous amount of money for a country like Nigeria, for any country, really. And this is the root of the problem. This money has not made it down to the people who are most affected by oil exploration.
Yeah. Is Nigeria's history with this, is this the story in the rest of Africa's oil-producing nations, the older ones, yeah.
Yeah, the Nigeria in many ways is the worst-case scenario, but it's also very different from the sort of newer oil boom, sort of booming oil countries. Nigeria, most of its oil, well, a lot of its oil is onshore, and traditionally it's been an onshore play. What that means is basically the oil companies literally, as I said, have to build their pipelines and their facilities in people's backyards, which has never been a recipe for good news. One of the things the industry is very excited these days about in Africa, all over Africa, is just how much deep water offshore exploration it's able to do. I mentioned that earlier in the program. Mm-hmm. I mean, 20 years ago, offshore oil drilling meant being a few miles out to sea. Nowadays, they have these drills that can drill 2,000 meters below sea level. Now, you're talking about drills that are several times the height of the Empire State Building. if you can imagine that. So what that means is that they can now go 100 miles out to sea and put up their platforms and their floating production storage and offloading vessels and not have to deal with the kinds of situations that they've had to deal with in Nigeria. So in a country like Angola, which is one of the really big up-and-coming oil producers in Africa, rapidly positioning itself to rival Nigeria, all of the oil is offshore, and the oil industry loves Angola. I mean, it's impossible to get a flight into Luanda just because, you know, it's just packed with oil people.
And what is the potential, or is there less potential for corruption in the offshore exploration and drilling of oil?
Yeah, if anything, it's more potential for corruption, actually, because it's so out of sight and out of mind, in a way. It's an enclave industry. Basically, the local natives and locals don't even see what's happening. It's all out to sea. The oil revenue comes into the national treasury, and in many cases, the government is not very transparent, so no one really knows what happens to the money. In Angola, for example, $4 billion of oil money went missing in the last few years of its civil war. We still don't really know what happened to it. It was probably used to buy weapons.
How do the oil companies view this corruption?
By and large, it's not how they would want to do business. People may disagree with that, but I think most oil companies just want stability and a peaceful operating environment so they can do their work and make their money. Now, of course, in many cases, they have been inevitably complicit with some of the problems. And there are people of genuine good faith in the oil companies, but oftentimes it's hard to really know exactly what to do when you're operating in this kind of environment.
One of the people that you talked with who works for an oil company is a fellow by the name of Chris Finlayson. You talk with him in Nigeria. What questions did you have for the oil companies, and how did they answer them?
Well, it depends on the country. But in Nigeria, the question is, well, why aren't you doing more for these people? I mean, the government, look, you know, the oil companies say, look, we have social projects, you know, socially responsible investing. We build school rooms and clinics and so on. These villages, we give them clean water when we can. But they say to us, they say to me, look, I can build, I can give them a schoolroom, but I can't design a curriculum. I can't hire teachers. I can build a clinic, but I can't run a healthcare system. At a certain point, this becomes the job of the government. In many ways, that's a fair point. But I think it's a little bit disingenuous when you take a situation like Nigeria, where a substantial portion of the country's income is from the oil companies, and it's only three or four major companies that are really the big players. It's not that hard for them to put a lot of. They can easily put a lot of pressure on the government to do more. They could also do more in the way of training locals to take some of these jobs. For example, I mean, at the moment they fly in people from all over the world, engineers, petroleum engineers, and so on. There's a huge shortage in the oil industry at the moment of skilled labor. There's no reason why there couldn't be a African Oil University, that could be funded by, several of the super majors. ExxonMobil made $5 billion last year. It's actually not that difficult for them to spend some of that money hiring consultants who can show them how to do these things.
Is there any interest on the part of oil companies in doing something like that?
Yeah, as I say, they all have their socially responsible programs. Exxon, has spent a great deal of money distributing mosquito nets to help fight malaria and so on. They do make their efforts, and I think in some cases they're getting better. It depends on the oil company. They're not all created equal. Some are better than others. And genuinely, I do have some sympathy. I mean, it's difficult in many of these cases where there are structural problems and more or less failed or semi-failed states to know exactly what you should be doing. The alternative is just not working there at all. But once you go in, it's very difficult. If you're coming in as a very skilled, very well-funded multinational oil company with an annual turnover greater than the GDP of the country you're working in, you've got the skills, you've got all the flashy toys, and people look to you to really make a difference. And in some cases, you can't make a difference. I mean, you can only make things worse.
What would happen if oil companies were to leave Nigeria?
It's a lovely sort of theoretical sort of situation. I mean, it's never going to happen because it was just one oil company, maybe. But I mean, competitive. The laws of the capital and the marketplace mean that it's very unlikely that Shell is going to just suddenly pull out of Nigeria when Exxon will just pick up all its contracts. And now the idea of them all clubbing together and leaving, I mean, I don't see that happening. But the Chinese will probably move in, would be the short answer.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is journalist John Gasvinian. He's the author of Untapped, The Scramble for Africa's Oil. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. You can join the discussion with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener now, a caller in Champaign County, line one. Hi.
Hi. I realize you're looking at it more as a business, but the geostrategic grand area planning sort of things that have gone on for decades are, I think, equally important, and perhaps you have some thoughts on that as well. But I wanted to start with a simple question about a Nigerian bribery case that has to do with, I don't think it's Alpha Aquitaine, but a French firm in combination with Halliburton. And it's interesting that it doesn't get more discussion because Cheney was in charge of Halliburton when this bribe to Sonny Abacha, I guess, was laid. And there is a process in France still going on about this. They take a long time to work out. But I don't know if, just on that specific point, do you know about that case and whether what's happening with it? And
sure, yeah. This is a Halliburton subsidiary. They're a subsidiary in Nigeria. You're right, this is a case that the Nigerian legal system has also been following for a couple of years. I don't know the exact latest, but as far as I know, it's still sort of in process. You mentioned geopolitics, by the way, and I'm glad you did. I mean, we have been talking about the business side of things quite a bit. In fact, the book actually deals largely with the kind of international, the kind of global scramble for Africa's oil. That's why I've called it, titled it, The Scramble for Africa's Oil. One of the conclusions I really draw is that this is a part of the world where the Chinese, the Americans, the Indians, the Europeans, the Australians, I mean, everyone is in there trying to get a little piece of this puzzle. It's an extraordinary competitive landscape right now. I mean, this is the last part of the world where you have these massive, massive exploration blocks that haven't been picked up, because traditionally the oil industry has been very reluctant to do business in Africa. And now, it's with the price of oil being as high as it is, they don't have the luxury of being able to stay away from Africa. And this is it's an incredibly exciting time for the oil industry. One of the things I do try to spend quite a bit of time on is the kind of global politics of it as well.
Well, the there has been some discussion on this airways on their show about the sort of the military U.S. military planning. There is this Trans-Sahel Strategic Initiative.
Yeah.
That's now supposedly going to be subsumed by the General Command for Africa. I just heard a report, I think it was on the BBC, saying that the Pentagon's not getting a lot of traction on where to locate it. Even Morocco, which is our favorite king on the African continent, does not see himself in the position to be able to offer a basing rights or whatever. So, and I understand that most other countries are sharing that sentiment. This is being looked at, and with the, I don't know, I guess you probably have mentioned the figures about the projections are that U.S. imports from Africa will triple or quadruple over the next decade if things go as people are suggesting they might. But necessity to have compliant regimes and that sort of thing is sort of fundamental if that's going to happen.
Yeah. Just on the the combatant command that you're referring to, this is AFRICOM. For a long time, Africa has been divided between three. The Pentagon has several combatant command centers that divides the world up into, and Africa has been traditionally split between several of them. Now they're coming up with a dedicated combatant command center for Africa called AFRICOM. They don't know where they're going to put it yet, the actual sort of tactical warehouse, if you will, the actual sort of combatant command center. Last I heard, a lot of African governments are tripping over themselves to welcome such a thing, which is unusual, actually, in many parts of the world. Not to be confused with the actual basing. No one's actually talking about creating a U.S. air base in Africa. There is already a base in Djibouti. Djibouti. But there was, for a while, some speculation about Sao Tome and the Gulf of Guinea. I think the sort of the bigger picture here, though, I want to be careful because people often get a little bit carried away and they think, oh, we're about to suddenly, you know, start invading Africa, you know, for the oil or whatever. I don't think that's quite going to happen. That's not really the scenario. But the Pentagon, to make this sort of oversimplify, it has three priorities for Africa. Number one, counterterrorism efforts. That's mostly a North African story and the sort of Horn of Africa, Somalia, and so on. They've been very quietly working for some time now in Somalia to kind of beat back radicalism. Number two, African peacekeeping. The sort of slogan is African solutions to African problems, and trying to get the African Union to step up and do more peacekeeping efforts in places like Sudan or wherever, largely because the U.S. does not want to get drawn into another Black Hawk Down type situation where it's actually sending troops to Somalia or whatever, U.S. troops. They're very keen to make sure Africans actually do their own peacekeeping. And the third priority is oil and keeping a stable operating environment, especially in the Gulf of Guinea. And that's where they've been working. They've been put together this Gulf of Guinea Commission, working with the governments there to help train their marines and their navies to police the waters there, which are very dangerous waters. And obviously with all the illegal oil bunkering that goes on, they're very keen to make sure that things remain stable there. And that's probably the sort of short answer.
I don't know. I would think I would reverse the order of priorities there and put oil first. But
I'm not putting those in order. Those are just the three.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. But I also would, I think, say that maybe it's been quiet here as far as what's going on in Somalia, but sort of sending in cruise missiles and shelling with boats on off the shore and diverting the one. The third carrier battle group that was going to go in the Persian Gulf, instead keeping it along the shore of Somalia and as you say near Djibouti, is hardly quiet. I guess in the Western press,
that's what I mean by quiet. Yeah, I mean that we don't hear very much about it. Not that.
Right. You know. All right. Well, thank you.
Okay.
Next, we talk with a listener in Martinsville, line two. Hi.
Yeah. Hello. I tuned in kind of late, so I hope this isn't off topic, but. Why are oil prices so high, and who or what actually does set the price of oil? And I'll hang up. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Why are oil prices so high? The answer to that is complicated, and I mean many, many factors go into the price of oil, both on the supply side and the demand side. Whether it's increased Chinese demand or problems in the Gulf of Mexico when we had the hurricane, or all kinds of things contribute to these things. Every time there's a kidnapping or a sort of an unpleasant situation taking place in Nigeria, the price of oil usually goes up by about $1 a barrel. Who sets them? No one actually. I mean, the sets them. It's more the market set them, basically. Oil traders set them. I mean, it's basically there's the spot price and then there's the future price. And I don't want to get too much into this stuff because I'm not a sort of petroleum markets specialist by any stretch of the imagination. But there's a lot that goes into the price of oil. And don't ask me whether it's going to go up or down, because I don't know.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, John Gosvinian, author of Untapped, The Scramble for Africa's Oil. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Here are the telephone numbers to join us. 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. If the corruption was ended tomorrow, what kind of difference would that make to the people of Africa in these nations producing the oil?
That's a very good question. There are people. Corruption and transparency issues in general have become very, very fashionable in the last sort of 5 or 10 years. In the kind of NGO community around the world. And we saw how much sort of Paul Wolfowitz made a priority of this at the World Bank and so on and so forth. And he's a bit late to the game, to be honest. But, I mean, this is something that there's a whole coalition of NGOs around the world that are called Publish What You Pay, that are convinced that if only we knew how much money was going in and coming out, you know, everything would be okay. You know, I think that's probably, you know, it would probably help enormously. But, you know, there are just deep, deep structural problems. I mean, fundamentally, as I try to draw out in the book, when you have a struggling, you know, poor African nation with no real capacity, and you suddenly have billions and billions of dollars of oil wealth coming in, it's never going to be a pretty picture. You know, if there's pre-existing ethnic conflict, it's going to get a lot worse. If there's, you know, an economy that is fundamentally underdeveloped, it's going to become overly reliant on imports, and, you know, because the currency will appreciate. This is the Dutch disease, as economists call it. You know, and this has been seen again and again in Africa. I mean, generally speaking, a very poor, struggling country is going to do worse when oil is discovered than it did before. And that's not just because of corruption, although corruption is certainly a big part of it.
Yeah. You want to talk a little bit more about Dutch disease and also another economic kind of factor, if that's the right word, something called rentier?
Yeah, without kind of getting too bogged down in economics, basically if you have a situation where, you know, suddenly billions of dollars of oil money is coming in, suddenly you have a lot of foreign currency in your country circulating. So that makes, you know, it artificially inflates the value of your own currency. And what that means is that the country becomes, imports become cheaper, basically, and the country becomes very dependent on imports. So suddenly, instead of buying local produce, local goat meat, people start buying beef that's been imported from France. People start buying, you know, Kellogg's cereals instead of, you know, locally ground millet or grain or what have you, because it's just cheaper and the quality is better, you know, and suddenly it's within reach. That's all well and good, of course, but what that means is that it destroys local agriculture and traditional industries, such as they may exist, which, again, is not a disaster if the country is suddenly wealthy. But the problem with oil and any natural resource is that the prices tend to fluctuate, and eventually the oil runs out. So it's very unpredictable, and ultimately there's kind of an end to the party, if you will, and there's a hangover when the oil finally dries out, which is that suddenly you've completely destroyed your traditional farming and agriculture and industries. Everybody's, you know, flocked to the cities to try to make big bucks, and the country's, you know, the economy has become decimated in the process. That's kind of a short version of the Dutch disease.
Yeah. Well, talk with us a little bit about the specifics of what has happened to the nation of Gabon.
Mm-hmm. This is a classic example of the Dutch disease. This is, on paper, a very prosperous country. It has one of the highest per capita incomes in Africa, about $3,000 or $4,000 a year per person, which is quite high by African standards. And you go in and you fly in, and it's quite impressive. They have these magnificent government buildings and palaces, and these great supermarkets with lots of, you know, fresh French food that's flown in, you know, French cheeses and so on. It's a former French colony. But, you know, the thing about Gabon is, and one of the things I talk about in the book is, I found it very hard to buy bananas. This is a jungle nation, 95% covered in rainforest. There are plenty of bananas in Gabon, but nobody's picking them. Bananas are actually imported from Cameroon, right next door. Gabon is dependent for 60% of its food needs on imported food. At one point, that was as high as 90%, actually, that figure. You know, there was a point at which Gabon was the world's highest per capita consumer of champagne. You know, basically, it's this very kind of nouveau riche country with a lot of kind of bling-bling spending and ostentatious living. Among the elites, people who have done very well out of the oil money. It's a small country of only 1 million people, so not a lot. Doesn't take a lot of oil for a lot of money to start flowing in, or to, you know, start being noticed. But its economy is not healthy, and the oil is beginning to dry out now. It's beginning to run out now in Gabon, and it's a country that's going to be facing some pretty serious hardship.
Yeah. The countries where oil exploration is now underway and there's hopes for finding oil, or there are indications that oil is there. The countries, including Equatorial Guinea, Chad, Sao Tome, Principe, Mauritania, is anything going on in these countries where people are trying to look at what has gone before and avoid the problems, avoid the mistakes?
Yeah, probably the best example of this is Chad, which you mentioned. This is one of the world's poorest and most troubled countries. It's a horrible, miserable place, quite honestly. It's very, very poor. It's twice the size of France. It only has 400 miles of paved road. You know, one car for every 100 people. It's, you know, 98% of the country lives without electricity. To give you an idea, that suffered through some terrible civil wars in the 70s and 80s, or 70s rather, and a very brutal American-backed regime in the 80s. Now, Chad is a country where Exxon discovered a fair amount of oil and said, we want to build a pipeline. It's a landlocked country. We want to build a pipeline to the coast of Cameroon to take the oil out and for, you know, for export. But obviously, we don't want to get involved in a really bad PR situation, etc. They approached the World Bank, and they together they came up with this kind of great scheme that was going to be a great new model for how Africa got it right, basically, how an African country got it right. Basically, the idea was that 85% of the money was going to go to priority sectors like schools and housing and roads and healthcare. You know, and a lot of the money was going to go into an escrow account in London so that the government couldn't, you know, kind of dip into it and so on. It didn't really work for a number of complicated reasons, but I spent quite a bit of time down in the south of Chad where the oil is explored. And really, it's an amazing place because there's no road down there. There's no paved road down there. You just take you know, you have to take public transport. There's no airport. The country has one airline, has an airline that has one plane. That doesn't even fly to the south of the country. Exxon has built their own airport down there, and they charter their own planes. But they weren't letting me come with them, so instead I took public transport down there, which is, you know, a couple hundred miles through the desert in a sort of cattle truck. And you get down there, and Exxon have a 120 megawatt you know, power station that generates electricity for themselves. They've got these basketball courts and air conditioned rooms and so on, surrounded by razor wire. This is a country that, you know, as I said, 98% of the country has no electricity. So, you know, Exxon by itself produces five times more electricity just for that compound than the entire country of Chad. And, you know, you can actually see the Exxon compound from outer space. It's such a sort of bright light surrounded by darkness. Mm-hmm. And I went down there, and just outside the compound you have this sprawling village of 10,000 people that has gradually built up around the compound just of people looking for work. You know, the town is actually called Aton, which is French for wait. You know, it's basically literally the place where people wait. People have just waited for jobs for years, and it's, you know, turned into this kind of squalid shanty town. It's quite an embarrassment to Exxon. So, I mean, that's like a little bit of a sort of real-world, you know, reality check, if you will. You know, it was a great model, but it didn't really work.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign County, line one. Hi.
How you doing? I have a question regarding the tiny country of Sao Tome. How soon do you think offshore oil development will occur there, and how significant will it be?
Yes. I think this is a story that was largely overhyped and oversold, to be honest. I don't think Sao Tome is going to be a major, major oil producer. I have no special information. Obviously, seismic data and things like that are jealously guarded by oil companies, so this is not any kind of insider tip for investors or anything like that. But I think that the sense that I'm getting is that, you know, Chevron went in there, they drilled a couple of wells, they didn't really come up with anything. I think they may probably end up exiting at some point this year completely. Exxon has failed to exercise its rights. There, a couple of other American companies have left. I don't think it's going to prove to be a major, major new oil producer. I think that the country that the listener is talking about, Sao Tome in principe, is also one of the world's smallest countries. It's two little islands of 150,000 people. It wouldn't take much oil, frankly, to change Sao Tome completely. This is one of the world's
That was exactly my point. It's right. The same size of our county here, and the impact could be, I mean, much greater than in a huge country like Nigeria.
Absolutely. I mean, Nigeria has 1,000 times as many people as Sao Tome. So, you know, the scale is pretty ferocious. Nigeria also practically runs Sao Tome. I mean, this has been one of the big question marks. You know, I mean, it's just how much Nigerian influence there is in Sao Tome. There's a lot of question marks over Sao Tome, and so far there's no oil coming out of Sao Tome yet, so it's kind of a wait-and-see situation. But you're right, it wouldn't take very much oil to really change things.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. If you'd like to talk with our guest, John Gasvinian, author of Untapped, The Scramble for Africa's Oil. Has there been any African country where oil has benefited the common people?
No, would be the short answer.
Yeah.
And I don't see it happening anytime soon anywhere either. Sadly, this is just the great tragedy of this story. I try not to write a very kind of doom and gloom book filled with pessimism. I try to really pepper it with a lot of colorful anecdotes and stories just to keep the story moving along. But you know, no amount of, you can't sugarcoat this story. Unfortunately, this is not a good news story for the African people. There are billions of dollars coming into Africa, and it's not really benefiting people who need it most. We're all aware of all the poverty and all the problems in Africa, and we'd like to believe that suddenly, you know, billions of dollars will make a great difference. But I think, unfortunately, it only tends to exacerbate problems.
Mm.
It's like winning the lottery, you know, when you have nothing and when you have a lot of problems. It doesn't necessarily, it changes your life, but it's not necessarily for the better.
Yeah, and how many of us blow through the money and
exactly.
it's all gone. Is there a story that you would like to share with us about your travels through Africa, through these countries, to leave us with?
Nothing comes. I mean, there's a lot of stories that are in the book. I mean, I think the thing that struck me the most was, you know, I tried to talk to everybody while I was there. I tried to talk to oil industry executives, politicians, activists, just ordinary people, priests and missionaries and just, you know, human rights workers and, you know, people working on the oil rigs and so on. And it's extraordinary how actually everyone you talk to, no matter what their perspective, sees that the fundamental problem is that this is not benefiting Africa and ordinary Africans. I mean, everyone understands that. Actually, everyone agrees on that. And it's quite extraordinary because you have people from all different perspectives, you know, militants and rebels and politicians and so on. I mean, but everyone sees that, look, fundamentally there's a problem here. And this came up again and again in every country I went to. There's a slightly different version of it in every country, but fundamentally, it's a problem, and it makes life worse. And I always say to people, look, oil by itself is not evil. It's just a black, thick substance that comes out of the ground. I mean, there's no reason why it has to create problems. I don't believe it has to. You know, I think that if it's managed well, it can really make a difference in people's lives for the better. It hasn't done that yet, and it takes some real challenge. It takes some real leadership and some real vision to make it do that.
Hmm. Let's take one more call before we run out of time. Chicago, line four, hi.
Thank you. The stability of the countries in that area, as well as others in the East and Middle East and South America recently, decided to have nationalization of their oil facilities and production, and I'm wondering how much more of this may be taking place in the regions of Africa, with greed being a factor and keeping things the way they are, disrupted and the controls of a few. I was just wondering if you could just thought of further aspects of nationalization and the inevitability of some countries saying we only have enough oil for ourselves in the near future, so it's going to be more precious and dear to them rather than exporting. Just some views on that. Thank you.
Yeah, full nationalization is probably not on the cards anywhere. It depends on the country. You know, the typical some of the newer producers, the typical story is this: oil company comes in, says, "Look, you've got a lot of oil, but we know that you have." You know, some of these countries, like Sao Tome, doesn't even have a university. So clearly, there's no one there who really knows how to exploit, how to run oil exploration. You need billions of dollars, and you need a lot of expertise. So the oil company comes in and says, "Look, we'll do a production sharing agreement where we'll explore for oil, but if we find any, first we have to recoup all of our costs, and then of what's left, we'll give you 25%. And the government usually signs on the dotted line. It's extremely unfair to the country. But, you know, over time, a country like Nigeria, for example, has really learned how to deal with the oil industry, and now they run a 55-45 joint venture where they actually have a controlling interest. Their national oil company has a controlling interest in the joint venture. Angola does something similar. But it takes time to build up to that level of expertise. But even then, you're not talking about full nationalization. Like NNPC, the Nigerian National Petroleum Company, could never run Nigeria's oil industry by itself. And it knows that, and everyone knows that. It has a controlling financial interest, but it doesn't really run the show. Shell and Exxon, Chevron run the show.
There we have to leave it. John, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
John Gasvinian has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of Untapped, The Scramble for Africa's Oil. The book is published by Harcourt.